Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Jessie Wren Marshall, author of Women in Peril, published by Bloomsbury Publishing.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a great idea. Today, we are drinking Bubbles in Peril, inspired by Jessie's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Jessie Wren Marshall has an MFA in fiction from New York University. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, New England Review, Electric Literature, Joyland, Zizaba, the Gettysburg Review, and elsewhere. Her play, Apa Girls, won the Kumu Kahua Theater's Hawaii Prize, and she has received scholarships from Malay Arts, the Sewanee Writers Conference, the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts, and the Community of Writers at Squaw Valley. She lives off-grid with her dogs on Hawaii Island. Of Women in Peril, author Claire Beams says, "Fearless and hilarious, brutal and large-hearted, as these brilliant stories carried me everywhere from deep space to a college dance classroom to the mind of a sex robot, I found myself astounded, not just by Jessie Wren Marshall's range, but by the depth of feeling she can summon. These stories are exhilarating, honest, yet saturated with love for the messy, doomed worlds they create. And I fell totally under their spell." Strong praise.
Indeed. In this brash and unputdownable collection, we meet a sex bot trying to outlast her return policy, a skeptical lesbian grappling with her wife's mysterious pregnancy, and a post-Earth colonist struggling to maintain her faith in humanity as she travels to Planet B. Whether they exist in the grounded realism of a college dance studio or the speculative world of deep space, these women push against social norms and family expectations to reclaim their power, understand their mistakes, and find a better future. Hilarious, heartbreaking, and defiantly optimistic, the 12 stories in Women in Peril balance humor and gravitas to explore the complexities of queerness, toxic relationships, parenting and divorce, Asian and Asian American identity, and so much more.
Awesome. How are you doing today, Jessie?
I'm really quite well. Thank you both for having me. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
So thank you for to have you.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to chatting with you about your work, but also having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving readings?
I do. I have a background in theater that I was never really able to capitalize on in a professional sense. So whenever I get to be in front of people or read something dramatically, I really just, I love it. I do.
That's a great background to have for that.
It's good for a lot of things, actually. I think there should be a study done on how many people or old theater kids who went into something like corporate America and they just kill it because
For sure.
They have that confidence and ability to just yes and everything.
I love that. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to either be a painter, an actor, or a writer. And then I decided that I didn't want to be an actor anymore because I'm short and it pissed me off that other people would get the roles that I could. That I had more talent for just because of the way they looked on the stage, you know?
Aww. Wow. Yeah, I realized that early on. That's sad.
Well, I did because I really wanted to be the Wicked Witch of the West in this production. And I ended up winning like Theater Student of the Year in my high school or something like that. But the casting director gave this role to this woman who was a foot taller than me with red hair. And I'm still bitter.
Clearly.
My purple was better. Okay, friends, I don't know what happened here.
So Jessie, how did this book come to be? What was the first story you wrote? And at what point did you know it was going to be a collection?
Yeah, those are two very different topics almost because the book had such a long gestation. So the first story that is the oldest story that is in this book was actually a version of it was my MFA application story. So, and I'm not a recent MFA graduate. This was like 15 plus years ago that I was turning out this story and trying to create a career for myself as a writer. And I love short stories. I love writing them. I love reading them. I think
that
that was really my first feeling of like, I think this is what I want to do, because I was shifting kind of from theater and from, I was in an English lit program, a graduate program, and I was trying to figure out like, what kind of approach am I going to have to words? Because I knew that my life was with words, but I wasn't sure what angle I was going to come at it from. And then once I started reading amazing short story writers like Laurie Moore and Amy Hempel, I just felt like, oh, this is it. This is where my voice belongs. So from there, I started writing more and more short stories. I did my MFA program. I never took a novel writing class. I was just like, short stories all the way, baby.
I hear that.
Yeah. And then I graduated and I became a teacher, and I taught middle school and high school English and whatever else they asked me to do. I just did it. And it was a really good education. My theater background also came in really handy as a teacher, because, you know, you're holding court for 45 minutes a day for every class. So that was a really good education. And then I left teaching, and that's when I really was able to focus on getting this book together. And I saw how it could be a collection. I saw how all the stories that I'd been writing kind of willy-nilly actually fell together in a way. And there was a logic to them. And I had always thought that you couldn't sell a short story collection, that agents weren't interested in them, that publishers weren't interested in them. So even though I still had that in my mind, I felt in my heart that it was a book. So I started querying agents, and I ended up with two amazing agents at Trellis Literary who, they've just been wonderful, and they're such seasoned professionals. I trust them so much. And they found an amazing home for the book with an incredible editor, Grace McNamee at Bloomsbury. And here we are today.
Well, that's interesting. And you just sort of answered my follow-up question, which was about getting a short story collection published, because I, you know, you read that it's kind of difficult for a debut, you know, book to be a collection as opposed to a novel. So it's great to hear that you got representation. It sounds pretty quickly on your collection.
Yeah. So I'll divulge a little secret, and maybe it's not a secret, but to me it was, which is that my agents counseled me to have the partial beginning of a novel ready to go so we could try to package that together with the collection.
Mm.
That publishers would maybe be a little bit more enticed to think, of course, we love the short stories, but we know that some readers are more interested in novels. So if we can kind of have both things packing.
That's great. That's good to know.
Yeah. But Bloomsbury is really wonderful. I think they, you know, they published Megan Kamale Kakamoto's short story collection, Every Drop is a Man's Nightmare, last year. And I love that book, and I love Megan. And it seems like they're really a proponent of this form that so many writers and readers are excited by. And yet there's just like a little bit of a shift in the marketing or in the way that readers approach books that needs to change in order for, I think, short stories to really take off as a form.
I agree.
Well, you know, people used to be able to make their living as short story authors. You know, I personally thought at one time that I was just going to be Flannery O'Connor, because I wrote 200 stories before I even touched a novel.
Mm. Yeah. Yes. And, I feel that.
Yeah. And I published four or five collections of stories through four different indie presses before I even thought I could commit to the long form. But people used to be able to live on writing stories. And I think that that's just not the case anymore so often these days. I think you're right about that whole thing with the market and novels. I'm super curious about something that you just said, though, with regard to teaching, is that how were you able to just walk away from it? I mean, was there some lucky conglomeration of events that allowed you to make that leap?
You mean financially?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or, I mean, like, that's a very courageous move to walk away from something that you were doing as a career. So I'm just fascinated by that. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah, I absolutely can. So I think there are a couple of things. One is like the financial risk and the instability that you're moving into if you go from a stable job to freelancing. And yeah, that is pretty scary to do. And it does take a certain amount of bravery. But I also have some support from my family. So that was really helpful. The place where I live in Hawaii, it's a burgeoning farm but it is not a successful farm. It originally was just raw land, and I and my partner built a tiny house and lived on that for many years. And slowly we've been building a bigger bamboo house kind of piece by piece, but it's still not quite done. And I don't know that it'll ever quite be done. But having that land allowed me to take off some of that financial burden. And so my family helped me to buy that land. So that was a big help. I want to be actually very transparent about that, because I know, how do people write things in this country? How do people be artists in this country? And I don't want to be like, well, it just takes a certain amount of talent, guys. I don't know what to say. Like, actually, it does take more than that. And I was really lucky to have financial support from my family. And I hope that everybody has that. And if you do have that, or if you have a partner who is willing to support you while you, quote unquote, stay home, but you're still working, like it's a job, you know, to be an artist. If you have that, I'd say, don't feel bad about it. Take it, honor it by doing your best and growing as much as you can as an artist.
Yeah. Because
this country does not have a system that allows artists to happen naturally. It's just like,
you're right. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think are some of the most significant narratives that girls and women grow up with and live with that put them in peril?
Damn, that's a good question. So the first one that comes to mind is stuff to do with women's bodies. You know, I was thinking about how a lot of the stories that I enjoy reading and a lot of the stories that are in this book are a reflection of women's bodies, are a distorted mirror of women's bodies, are kind of trying to encapsulate what it is that living as, presenting as a woman in society does to your psychology, because you're constantly seeing yourself being seen instead of just walking through the world like doop-a-doop-a-doo, right? We have mirrors around us all the time. And I think it's exacerbated now by social media and Instagram and TikTok and all those things.
Yeah.
So I think women's bodies are really fascinating because they are so central to human life. They are needed for human life. And yet at the same time, everybody has such a complex relationship to them, and not just women, but I think everybody has an idea about women's bodies, whether it's to vilify them, whether it's to overly praise them, whether it's to put them on a pedestal, or a million other different ways of interacting with the idea of a woman's body. And part of that is because of just constant imagery that we are forced to see of ideal bodies and bodies that don't fit that ideal. And then how do we feel about that? And people have such strong reactions, don't they, to seeing a person's figure. And it just don't feel like it's the same way for men's bodies. There's something about beauty and worth that I think is really tied to an ideal feminine figure.
I agree.
And it's messed up. It's totally messed up. And, you know, I'm from the era when it was Vogue and Teen Beat. You know, it wasn't necessarily all of this online stuff, but I really am concerned for young women today and how seeing people whose images are altered by AI or filters, how that might affect what they see when they look in the mirror. And maybe we just need to push on through and get to the point where we can walk around with an AI film around our bodies all the time so we can project whatever we want whenever we want, and then we'll finally be free because we'll have total autonomy over how we can present to the world. Is that a crazy idea?
I think it really is.
That's really interesting. And I think as someone in Gen X, I see such a difference with what's going on with Gen Z. And so I think a lot of the body positivity and all of these other elements that just weren't there when I was a teenager are fascinating to see. How are they going to impact the world? How will culture move forward? And will it stop expecting these unreal expectations from women's bodies? In other words, is this younger generation luckier for that reason? So I'll throw that out there. But I'm also interested in terms of your book, Jesse, in how the significance of culture is called out and accepted or not accepted in this collection. Did you know how you would balance those themes that came through the book or choose the assembly of the ordering of the stories?
Oh, so by culture, I'm sorry, can you tell me what you mean by that? Because that could mean a...
Sure, I mean like how a number of the different characters, you see some representation of some of the characters as being Asian, you see some kind of a mixed heritage, and then you see the reaction of some of the other characters in the other stories, like where it becomes significant what ethnicity someone is in the piece in terms of how the piece is reading.
Absolutely. Okay. So I am mixed race and I am bisexual. And I think those kind of multiplicity things tend to need to find different forms to express themselves. So it would be strange if every protagonist that I wrote in a short story collection was exactly like me, right? I mean, I guess you could get away with it if it were a thematically linked collection. But for me, I would get bored, I think, if I just had to limit myself to writing half Japanese, half Caucasian characters, you know, that just seems silly. So necessarily, because I am diverse, the book itself has to be diverse. And I also think that there's a sense of like living between different worlds that to some extent I inherited that because I grew up as a mixed race person in a very, very white, small town. And so I identified as being other or different before I had the words to even express that. So it's very ingrained in my sense of self. And I think it's also really interesting to explore that kind of schism between who you feel you are and who the world sees you, which is maybe why I was harping on women's bodies so much a minute ago. So there's that aspect of it. And then there's also just the idea that I think we are all multiple. I think that we all can relate to different aspects of otherness, regardless of what our ethnicity is, regardless of what our sexuality is, anything like that. Regardless of where we come from, we all feel like outsiders at some point in our lives. I assume so. Maybe there's a person who doesn't, but I just think they're in denial.
That could be. Most people I know feel the same way.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And I know that there was a couple of stories in the book that I was reading that I felt had really poignant moments. I guess that's where this question is coming from. For example, the pianist character who is having a first kiss with this kind of gross white guy. And it seems as if his fixation on her does not have to do with her herself, but more so his kind of, I don't know, desire to look for a certain type of person that he's attracted to or whatnot. And I just thought that you did such a nice job balancing that in these stories. So I just wanted to make sure I said that.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a tricky one, I think. It's always hard to tell what is too subtle on the page and what is like the right amount of pointing to a character's flaws. I agree, he is gross, but I don't think that he knows he's gross, and he's also a teenager, so maybe he'll grow out of it. I don't know. There's hope for everybody to change. But yeah, I do think that like this is a really interesting question, and I think that I'm somebody who wants to write towards complication rather than simplicity, and I'm interested in the messy multiverses of ourselves. And in this book, it's not only that there are characters who have different backgrounds, but also the stories tend to switch genres from one story to the next. Like somebody who likes a more realistic story, you will find some stories like that in this book. But if you want something that's more sci-fi adjacent, a little bit speculative, a little bit more plot driven, you can find that in here too. And then tonally, I think there's always a mix. I try to aim for there being a mix of funny and poignant, sad, hilarious. They really go together for me. And I think that's a little bit of this, you know, the Japanese philosophy that says there's always going to be sadness laced into beauty. And that's what makes life beautiful because it ends. And that's what makes the sunset beautiful because it is temporary.
I love that. One of the stories really stood out to me. It was My Immaculate Girlfriend. It was so unbelievable that it was believable. And it was funny. And the ending was unexpected. I also love the list writing on the back of the receipts. There was just so many great things in that story. So I've got a couple of questions. One is, where did the idea for the story come from? And the other is this a story about miracles?
I'll answer the second question first. Yes, it is absolutely a story about miracles and the miracle of faith. And it was originally called Faith, a Love Story, because to me, I'm very interested in the fact that you choose to love people and yet you can never really know them. I mean, not like you can ever really know yourself either, right? But you can never really gain access to someone else's interior world. So you just have to trust them. You ultimately just have to have faith that they're going to try their best not to destroy you at some point. You know, it's a pretty amazing thing to do that. And I think that love is a miracle. I think that the fact that anybody finds each other in this world and stays together and supports each other for however long, if it's, you know, a, a 2-month relationship that was meaningful to you, or if it's a lifelong relationship that is necessary to who you are. I think that they're all miracles. And I think that this life is way stranger than we give it credit for. If you look into pop science, like I call it pop science because I don't really understand science, but I like reading about it, you know, and like quantum physics, for example, you just cannot believe that this is how the world operates. It seems magical. And I think that it is magical. I think that miracles are everywhere, actually. What was the first question?
I don't know. I like that second answer so much. First question was, where did you get the idea for this story?
Yes. Okay. So I have a very good friend who is basically like my sister. I do have a sister as well, and I love her. But this friend I've known since she was 7. So we really grew up together doing theater, and she was a dancer. And she has been partnered and then married to her partner for decades, really long time. And so the idea for this kind of relationship dynamic, where one person is maybe a little bit more logical by the book and wants things to be how they are, you know, a realist, that is my friend's partner. And my friend Mary is the one who is a little bit more la la la, it's all gonna be fine, don't worry about it. And I found that in that relationship to be like full of so much conflict in a really interesting way, because my friend Mary can just skirt around the conflict and she just keeps swimming, you know, Dory like. And that somehow works. Like, they clearly have a functional relationship because they've been together for so long and they're intertwined and they need each other. But it was just a fascinating dynamic that I had trouble figuring out. So I decided to write fiction about it.
That's great. That's great. I love that.
That's so fun. And I really like how you mentioned, you know, being bisexual and also being biracial, and how a lot of the relationships differed from story to story of what people's orientation was and all of that sort of thing too. One of my favorite stories in the book is the one called Late Girl, because it's so interesting how you create suspense and where you're choosing to be experimental with the structure of a story. Can you talk to us about writing that story or some impulses you had while you were working on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I like that you mentioned the suspense of it, because it is kind of a subtle mystery. In my mind, many stories that don't appear to be mysteries actually are, because there's a central question that I'm kind of circling around, even as a bunch of other stuff can be happening in the plot and with the characters that is perhaps not pointing towards that mystery. But in this case, the question is a mystery of memory and what actually happened to the protagonist during her accident. She had a car accident, lost some of her memory. So that's one aspect of the story that's driving the plot forward. And it is resolved by the end, so I hope it's satisfying. But at the same time, there's a mystery about her feelings of affection for her teacher and where that is coming from. So she's trying to figure out that internal mystery about herself and her sexuality and her desire. And then there's a third layer, which is she used to be a ballet dancer and she was told that she wasn't good enough by her teacher. So now she is trying to reconnect with dance and with her body as a college student. And she's going into a modern dance class. And that's a different way of moving. It's a different relationship to dance as an art form than ballet, which is very strict. So how I came to this, I have a little bit of a background in dance, but I was never very good at it. I was never very exceptional at it, but I loved it. And I think it was a very meaningful activity for me to pursue. It gave me an ownership over my body that I don't think I would have had otherwise. I remember being a teenager and I felt so much embarrassment at just like the existence of my body in space.
I think all teens feel that way.
I know.
They cover themselves in hoodies and they just don't want to even be seen.
Oh yeah. Clothing. Teenagers is clothes and what they're wearing. Teenagers just don't know how to present to the world, right? Because it feels like every choice matters so much and you can never change it once you decide who you are. Just not true. But yeah, it was a tough time. And yet if I performed on stage or if I was in dance class, I felt like connected to my body in a way that was honest and accepting. And sure, my body still had limitations. I couldn't put my heel behind my head like some of the girls could, but I still felt a sense of unity, which I did not have when I was just walking down the street and some guy would wolf whistle at me. You know, I felt such disassociation between myself and the way that it was received by the world. That it's really great to have those spaces where you can connect with your own body.
Can you take us through the process of writing a short story? What like inspires you first? Is it a character, a thing, a line? And I'm also curious about how writing a short story is different than a longer work like a novel.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think it is a little bit different for each story. They have their own genesis. Is that the plural of genesis?
I don't know.
Okay. They each have their own way of forming. For more of my recent stories, I have felt like there is a question that I want to pursue, or there is an image that I can't get out of my head. And I know that it belongs in some kind of narrative format, but I might not know what that is. Because I also do playwriting. So I can talk a little bit specifically about the title story in this collection, Women in Peril, because I wrote it after I had titled the collection. And I thought, you know what? This is a good title. I think it needs a story. I think it should be a story that takes place in deep space. And I had been trying to write a play that had kind of a similar situation as the one that's in the story now. And it just wasn't landing and I couldn't find it. And then I tried writing it as a story and I wrote the whole thing out and I did the, you know, good preparation of actually structuring it and writing an outline beforehand to get all the plot points in there because I knew it would be a plotty story rather than a meandering character-driven story. And it still just felt blah. And then I found the structure of writing it in a series of blurts, which are like social media, like tweets. And that just unlocked something in the voice. And that character became really interesting because what the action of the story is that she is a womber. She is a viable womb who is going to planet B in order to repopulate humanity because Earth has gotten to be untenable for life because of environmental destruction. Pretty heavy and pretty disturbing, but social media and blurts are really light and superficial. And I thought that it would be really interesting to use that form to tell this heavy story because when you are dealing with trauma, I think that it's often really a super helpful coping mechanism to make light of the situation and to use humor to remove yourself from it because it's too heavy to deal with all at once. So that character really came alive when she could talk about something like, you know, how ugly she looked on the spaceship and that they wouldn't allow mirrors to be on the spaceship because they didn't want the girls to get depressed on their long journey to planet B. Like, that's superficial, but it is the kind of day-to-day stuff that you would perhaps think about when you can't think about the fact that all of your family has died and like all of humanity's future rests on your shoulders and uterus, right? It's too heavy. So yeah, that's an example of how that story started with just the idea of just the concept, like a pretty high concept story, but then it took finding the form to find the character's voice. And I think most of my stories end up being very voice driven. I love language. I love playing with language. I love subverting tone. Once you've set something up, if you just go in a different direction, like that can be a wonderful surprise on the page.
Yeah, I thought that the blurts reminded me of like Star Trek logs.
Totally. Yes. That's a great comparison. Yes.
And I was like, ooh, she's making a feminist version of Star Trek logging. Okay.
Totally. But I mean, so Captain Picard is my captain. And I feel like, you know, he's very serious and British sounding. And she is not very serious.
Yeah.
Very American.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. And actually, I want to go back to this just because you were talking about that idea of creating suspense. And I think that that's such a significant aspect of your style, because I see it moving through a lot of the stories. It's like this thing, like in Annie 2, the first story of the collection, you don't know where that's going, but it's a shock. But you, when you start to feel the suspense, you definitely travel with it. And then also in Late Girl, there's that suspense element. In Women in Peril, also that kind of three-quarter twist as the story moves through its narration. Do you know when you start creating a narrative what the twist will be? Or does it come to you? Do you even know whether the story is going to have that sort of twist structure?
I rarely know what the ending will be. I usually know that there will be a moment when it needs to shift into something other, but I don't usually know what that other thing is going to be. And then the first half of the story will kind of tell me what the shift should be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. How long do you feel like, I feel like I mean, I'm just throwing this out there. I feel like for me, some stories come almost completely whole. Like they just are what they are and they don't require much. And other stories, I could sit there fooling with them for years and not be quite happy with them. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like there's generally a certain amount of time or period in which I feel the story needs work for it to be where I want it to be to publish it. Do you feel like you have a certain amount of time you like to work on each story? How does that work for you?
It does vary widely between one story and the next. Like you're saying, some stories just arrive and they are kind of perfect in their structure already. So then it's just a matter of revising to where the language and the character is up to snuff for really perfect structure.
Right. Like when I was writing this feminist dystopia collection, those stories took forever. Because I'd want to like write part of it and then think about it for a few weeks and then write more of it and come to the end. But when I was writing like more of like an erotic magical realism context, those stories felt like they flowed out almost like the majority of them in one draft. And then when I was writing a book that was like about ghost narratives, those ones had a different timing and a different feel to them too. So I was just wondering how you feel about how long you think each story takes you.
I'm curious, is that because of the genre shifts? Do you think that you had a different expectation for a particular genre? If it's erotic, then you're kind of like, we just need to have the payoff and the fun and get to those high points. And as long as the story does that, it's successful to me?
Well, for me, it was because, for one thing, the ghost narrative book, I was making a different conception of the afterlife with every story because I wanted it to be kind of a mindfuck thing where you'd be reading the collection and it would just be this absolute trip you could talk about later to other people. So I really spent time being thoughtful about what new world I wanted to bring in next. And that's why that was so time consuming. But when I was writing like Man Jacket or People with Holes or things like that, I felt like those were based on philosophical or gender-based type of playful elements in the stories. And I felt like those came very fluidly and very quickly. It depended for me on theme. It depended for me on style. It depended for me on level of research. And because you seem to be one of those who likes to play in a lot of different genres too and do some hybridity. So I was just curious how your process was.
What you're saying really rings true to me. I think that perhaps at the very beginning, we have a concept of what we want the experience for the reader to be.
Yeah.
And some of those experiences are like pop rocks. But it's not a long-lasting effect. And other ones, you want the story to linger and really be something that they come back to in their mind over the course of months or even years. And of course, you can't dictate a reader's experience, but I think to some extent, I'm always trying to replicate a particular experience that I've had that was meaningful to me. And I do like pop rocks and I do like a savory umami meal that is subtler as well. And that is something that genre, I think, helps you key into really quickly, because if you are writing in a genre that it has certain tropes that the reader can recognize right away, it's almost like you can just skip the backstory. You can skip all that stuff and just mention it really fast, because we know that the story is going in a particular direction and you can subvert that direction a little bit, but you still have to give a payoff to some extent because that expectation exists in the reader's mind of like, this feels sci-fi, right? We're going to get to like some high conflict moment of a climax where we survive or we don't, right? And I think that's really fun to know. It's almost like you're in cahoots with the reader ahead of time, where if it's a story that's more traditional literary fiction and it's character driven, and maybe that's exciting because you have a lot of experimental avenues that the story can go down and you're allowed to explore all of those without restriction. But at the same time, it's perhaps harder for the reader to have a map ahead of time to know the points you might hit along the way. So they have to invest a little bit more of their will and faith in you that you're going to take them somewhere worthwhile. I really am not talking about writing process at all. I just keep skirting around that question.
No, that's great. Speaking of that, writing is such a solitary endeavor. And I'm wondering how you're feeling now that your book is out in the world, now that it's not in your hands anymore. It's just out there.
I feel great about it. It was so ready to be a public item for consumption. It was really ready to fly free from my hands. I think that I'm a little bit controlling. That's probably true for a lot of writers. There's perhaps a reason why I moved more towards writing fiction from writing theater, because in theater, it's very collaborative art form from the get-go. And, you know, a play does not really exist until it's performed. And that is ceding a lot of control to other artists that I love to do it, but it can be hard to find collaborators and also hard to find funding to produce work. Whereas you can sit alone in a room and write to your heart's content and nobody is looking over your shoulder necessarily. So yeah, I think I got off topic.
No, I was just asking how it felt to have your book out in the world.
How it felt. So I'm so happy to just see it in people's hands. I'm so happy to let it exist as its own thing and have the multiple interpretations that will happen for the different stories and the multiple reactions and emotions that people will feel. It's very surreal, though, to see it in bookstores next to other books that I have read. It's kind of like, whoa, look, you're hanging out with my friends. So cool.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. I'm just still thinking about your theater comments and getting the funding and the control that you keep over it. I think that's super accurate and fascinating. And now that your book is out, what's nice is no one can change it, at least in this edition, right?
That's true. But if anyone from Hollywood would like to, I am taking their calls. So,
Okay. Looking for some film rights here. Probably Women in Peril. Shoot that over to Netflix. I'm a screenwriter too. So,
Then you understand it. I think there is something like so collaborative when, say, you're writing a screenplay that is intended as a screenplay versus like this is IP, like this is original content that exists in this form. So I'm happy for anybody who wants to adapt it into anything else because this original form exists. And somebody could go and find it.
Right. And because even if you sell it for some money and whatever it is doesn't match your original concept, it's okay because your original concept is still what has your name on it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And on this topic of IP, that's really interesting because I have a novel I'm looking for an agent for right now. And I have the screenplay that I already wrote for the story. And so my plan is to try to get the novel published, own the IP, and then try to sell the film so that that way I can get in on a screenwriting credit for my own book. That'd be cool.
Yes. And get a bigger percentage because you own the content based on. That's very smart.
And then my name's on it. And then, yeah, so that's great. And yeah, you're right about the collaboration though. I mean, like in Hollywood, somebody could change what, like 48% of your script and not even have their name on it. And then that's it. You lost it's not a static medium for sure. Great. Well, I'm excited and I'd like to see some of your stories turn into little films. I think that would be so fun. If you know anybody who makes short films, you could even put one in the festival circuit. Just go for it. I think the first story or the Women in Peril would be great short films or even longer films, right?
Yeah. I appreciate that. I'm a huge fan of adaptation. When I did theater, I would often go to literature or fiction to try to find something to adapt because I think that process of using a story that perhaps already has a life in the mind of the audience is really interesting because then you can play with that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Well, fascinating. We are looking forward to sharing with our audience, letting them hear you read an excerpt from Women in Peril. But before we do that, let's have Ran tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's Booktail cocktail is called Bubbles in Peril. We're calling it that because your book's title and also because you mentioned you were into Japanese whiskey and champagne at the moment. So I just kind of combined them. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 2 ounces of whiskey, 2 ounces of cranberry or pomegranate juice, champagne, and a lemon twist. You add the whiskey and the cranberry or pomegranate juice to a shaker with ice. Give it a shake. And then strain it to a coupe glass and you top it with champagne and garnish with a lemon twist.
That sounds terrific. And I am going to make it as soon as I get back home.
Oh, good.
Yum. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the passage you'll be reading for us today?
Sure. So I think because of the stories that we discussed already, I'm going to switch to a different one. I think I'd like to talk about Late Girl and read that one for you.
That sounds great. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. Late Girl. Roman used to say that the body never lies. He probably still says this, but not to me. His target audience is girls from 7 to 17, young women who have trained their bodies to repeat the past in an attempt to perfect it. I believed he hated me. Not me, exactly, but the parts of me that were loose and untrained. My bent knees, my lazy feet, most untrainable of all were the parts that were new, my padded hips, breasts, and thighs. Each of us felt the betrayal. Beneath the comforting din of banged point shoes and soles being scraped into submission, the dressing room girls exchanged whispers about the way our teacher had begun to look at us in class, like we weren't silly little fools anymore, but fully grown idiots. We had disappointed Roman by sprouting flower bulbs of breasts and half-moon asses, fleshy protrusions that filled us with pride at the bus stop, but muddied our talent at the studio. One evening, we were doing PK turns across the floor in pairs. PKs are simple to execute, but hard to perfect. Roman clapped his hands and pointed at me. Again, I trotted back to the corner and joined the next group. Roman wore his usual expression of stern alertness, but his eyes sparked with cold fire. By the time I'd spun to the other side of the room, he had pulled his lips back in a grimace. He pointed at the corner. Again.
Me?
Who else? You. Again. I hesitated, then tripped getting back to the starting point. There was no one left to join me. I stretched out my arms and settled my hands into place, trying to ignore the flaming tower of displeasure. Roman. Lurking in my peripheral vision. I had spent every moment of class desperate for his attention, but when he finally gave it to me, I wanted to disappear. Watch, he said to the girls. See what Chelsea's doing wrong? The pianist began. It was a song just for me. I felt very close to crying, but I knew Roman wouldn't like it if I cried, so I whipped around and tried to smile the way a Japanese geisha might smile, full of secrets. I told myself I loved ballet, but I could not hide the truth that escaped from my body. Still late, he barked. Turn, turn, turn. Roman clapped his hands to emphasize the timing. I saw his hands, but couldn't hear the music. Blood pounded in my ears to an alternate tempo. Stop, he said. The music stopped, but I kept turning, eager to reach the end of the room. Roman's body approached mine. He reached out with a single finger and pushed my shoulder. I stumbled and fell out of point. When a dancer is late, she must rush, he said. And then she loses her balance. Although I was standing still, my muscles snapped and twitched on their own, loaded with the current of his attention. He moved in front of the other dancers and imitated me. I saw his knees go floppy and watched his chin droop to the side. Instead of spotting the wall by snapping his head, he let it lag behind his body. Our pianist improvised a jumbled comedy of notes to highlight Roman's performance. I held my breath. Beauty is never in a hurry, Roman said. The correct tempo must come from the body. One and two and three and four. What is the human heart? It's a clock, droned the girls. A late body is a sloppy body. Roman swung around behind me and slapped at my butt. Tuck this in. This is disgusting. He flicked at my stomach, which retracted in response. Get that big tummy out of here. The girls giggled in their corner. For the rest of that week, I would walk past the dressing room and hear the echo of Roman's words. Big tummy, get it out of here. At that age, I often thought about my body, specifically my thighs. For several months, I'd felt they were greater, more, than the other girls' thighs. I asked my mother to buy me new tights, but she hadn't, and now the old ones had stretched so thin the pink fabric looked white. But it wasn't until this moment, trembling under Roman's gaze, that I wondered if the thickness meant I was fat. Without warning, Roman clapped his hands and released me. I dove behind the other girls and self-soothed by performing stretches. My favorite stretch, the one I did whenever I felt bored or confined, was to stick out a leg and point and flex my foot. My ankles were very loose, my arch strong, and doing this particular thing made me feel good, like a natural ballerina. While I stood there, pointing and flexing and pretending not to be upset, a few tentative hands reached out to pat me. I pulled away. We were not silly little girls anymore, and they were not my friends. Roman had made them my competitors, my enemies. A few months later, he told my mother there was no reason for me to continue at the studio. I lacked the ballet body. I had no sense of rhythm. In short, I would never become one of the photographs on Roman's office wall. The wall was a map of the stars, former students who had gone to famous schools and then scattered themselves across the ballet universe. Through their combined light, they made a constellation that looked like Roman. My mother asked what other kinds of dance I might do, tap, jazz, that sort of thing. In the silence that followed, I realized how stupid my mother was. Not stupid, exactly, but uneducated, a barbarian in the House of Angels. Roman explained that he had ruined me for all other forms of dance. Nothing else would be ballet. He had taught this to my body, and my body would not forget. This was Roman's gift to me, and also his curse. After he walked us to the door, my teacher floated one hand beneath my right breast and turned his palm upward while staring at my mother. He was presenting me to her as if she did not know me at all. "Look at this," he said. "The body never lies." During the fourth week of my sophomore year at college, on a Saturday night heavy with parties, I ran into the street and was almost hit by a car. According to my suite mates, Lauren and Frankie, the three of us had too much to drink at French House, and I convinced them to go off campus. None of the bars would let us inside, so Frankie used the school's app to request a car to take us home. While we waited for our ride, I apparently danced with a lamppost and ran up and down the sidewalk, getting into arguments with random people. Lauren and Frankie said they were too exhausted to stop me. At one point, I seemed distraught and threw my body against a wall. Then, without warning, I dashed into the street. My boyfriend Simon was the student driver who'd been assigned to pick us up. It was his car that approached me in the street. But at the last moment, the car swerved and hit a tree. As everyone else rushed forward to see if Simon was okay, I leapt backward. There was no reason to get out of the way at that point, but I was drunk and my reaction was slow. If I'd been sober, I might have landed on my feet. Instead, I landed on my back and hit my head on the curb. Simon's car was totaled, but Simon was fine. Even the tree was fine, though it now carries a horizontal scar across its trunk. I went to the hospital. My doctors agreed that my body was all right, but my brain was not. I had thought my brain was part of my body, that the two were, in fact, inseparable, but the doctors kept referring to them as opposites. No lasting trauma in the body, they informed me. And yet I had memory loss.
Thank you. Such a compelling passage.
That was great.
Oh, thank you.
No, that was really good. We have one last question, and that is, do you have any advice for new writers?
Yeah. I mean, the most fundamental thing is to read. Follow your reading passion. Please do not think that you have to read whatever the good things are. Like, if let's say that you want to be in The New Yorker and you're reading The New Yorker stories and you feel like, this isn't really what I am drawn to, but I feel like I want to be in The New Yorker and I want that prestige. So I'm going to just try to write stories like that. Like, this is not the way to find your place in the artistic world. I think the world of literature is vast and very diverse, and that's such a good thing. And we all just need to be pursuing our own interests, right towards joy, right towards what excites you on the page, and just keep reading the things that you can't put down. And that's probably where your writing will end up.
Excellent advice.
Great advice. And I think too, I could be intuiting this wrong, but I think that I'm not, which is to say that if somebody is reading The New Yorker and it's not turning them on, find what does turn them on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many amazing literary magazines. There are so many amazing writers who are not in that upper echelon of the literary establishment. That's part of the reason why I left New York. So I did my MFA at NYU, and I have, you know, really fond memories of that time. But I did feel like I was reading the exact same things that everyone else in my program was reading. And so we would try to have conversations and we would say, oh, did you read that? Oh, yes, I read that. Did you read that? Yes, yes. And so there was like such a small amount of diversity, really, because we were so influenced by that New York literary scene.
Yeah.
And that was a while ago. So I think that it has become more varied and more diverse now than it was at that time because of probably like social media is a huge thing, right? Like it, just being able to say, hey, I read this 20-year-old story that was in a small literary magazine and it's amazing and everybody should read it. And you can actually share that widely with the world. That's really fantastic. That's a wonderful use of the internet.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. And I think people are more often selecting toward diversity, toward inclusion, toward having a wide array of choices and representation in college classes as well now.
And that helps student writers find someone who is in their tribe, right? It's somebody who is sure. In your group that you feel like I'm in conversation with this person, whether they know it or not. I'm going to write with and for and towards this group of writers who really inspire me. And I think that's the way to really find your voice and also find a group of people who you want to continue to make work with. Because although we are sitting alone in a room, the really amazing thing about publishing a book is that it connects you with other writers. And that has been amazing, that amount of community. Like right now I'm talking to you guys, and I would not be if I hadn't published this book. Like, I think going public is awesome. It's still like to go with your rating.
Agreed, agreed. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really enjoyed talking with you about your book and hearing you read from it. Thank you so much.
This was an amazing conversation. I had such a nice time.
I hope more readers engage and go get Women in Peril. It's a great collection. And so everyone order Jazzy's book and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on book tales, readings, and drinks. Also, check out Hot Redhead Media's new sister podcast, Heat, which celebrates women's contributions in TV and film, and subscribe to Book Tales, which releases once a month for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.